Shalom Hadavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the book of Isaiah. This is session number 7, and we're working our way through the book of Isaiah using Ariel's exegetical outline notes developed by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. All right, let's take a few minutes to review where we were last session. In the last session, we finished up speaking about the kingdom, or Isaiah. God finished up speaking about the kingdom in chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Then we jump back to the prophet's present time in chapter 2, verses 5 through 11. And we came across a very, very important principle that we need to burn into our brains, that we need to be very aware of as we go through the book of Isaiah. And that principle, it can be worded this way. What happened in Isaiah's day, what happened in Isaiah's day will happen again during the tribulation period, only much more severely. And this is the reason for the movement back and forth among the time frames. You start out in Isaiah's day, and we have a judgment upon Israel. Then we move to the tribulation, and there will be another judgment upon Israel. Then back to the Isaiah's day to start the process all over again. So again, that principle will be repeated over and over again throughout the book. What happened in Isaiah's day will happen again during the tribulation period, only much more severely. So keep that in mind, please, a very important principle. We then looked at Isaiah's political setting, and we saw that the southern kingdom was keeping common cause with the heathen on the east. They were following the religious practices of Edom, Moab, and Ammon. They were also copying the religious practices of the heathen on the west, the Philistines, the soothsaying of the Philistines. So Judah was not in good shape. In fact, this idol worship and practices of the East continues, and even today in modern Israel, this is a concern. This has happened. This is an article I scanned in from the Jerusalem Report in 2003, acknowledging that meditation had gone mainstream with many Israelis, because the Israelis have to spend 2 years in the army. They get out of the army, and many of them go to the East, far east, to India, and bring back with them the meditation, Eastern meditation, and Eastern religions. For example, see this beautiful Israeli gal on the left? She's sitting and meditating. And what is she meditating before? She has lit a candle, and she's meditating before this idol. So we have Eastern, far Eastern, religious practices in Israel today as well. And it'll be the same situation in the tribulation period. And idol worship is back in the land, flagrant idol worship. In this article I scanned in from Biblical Archaeology Review, here these ladies were dancing before this little clay idol and giving thanks to this idol. Well, we jump from the prophet's present time, about 700 B.C. Now we jump in verses 2:12 through 4:1 back into the tribulation period. Again, here's that principle. What happened in, back up, what happened in the prophet's present time in Isaiah's day will happen again. It'll happen again in the tribulation period, only much more severely. We learned that in the tribulation period, Israel would have no shame. Now here's a picture of a gal hiding her face in shame for what she's done, but this will not happen in the tribulation period. Many Israelis will be brazen and challenge God with their sin. Well, God never leaves us in rebuke, and he then in verses 2 through 6, he moves us into the kingdom to give us the hope of the future and to encourage Israel to live righteous lives. So in verses 2 through 6, we're looking at the kingdom. And as we looked at the kingdom, we were introduced to the messianic person. And we saw that we looked at the branch motif, and let's summarize that. The messianic person would be a servant, he'd be a man, he'd be a king, and he'd be God. And these are the four themes that the Gospels, Mark, Luke, Matthew, and John, pick up in their Gospels. We also were introduced to the doctrine of the remnant, which basically says this: within Israel as a whole, there's always a believing remnant, Israel, the remnant. And we also saw there'd be five manifestations of the Shekinah glory in the Messianic kingdom. It would appear in the Holy of Holies of the Millennial Temple. God's glory would appear in the Millennial Temple. Secondly, it would appear over Millennial Mount Zion. Third, The Shekinah glory will be around Jerusalem as a wall of fire. Fourth, it'll be with Israel. And fifth, it will appear in the person of Messiah, Yeshua. Jesus is a visible manifestation of God. What were the features of the Messianic kingdom we covered then? The sixth feature we saw in chapter 4 is the presence of the glorious Messianic King in verse 2. All Jewish people will be believers in verse 2. In fact, the Jewish people will be holy in verses 3 and 4. And there will be five manifestations of the Shekinah glory. So quite an amazing look into the kingdom. From the kingdom, then, we jump back into chapter 5. We start chapter 5, verses 1 through 7, back in the prophet's present time. And that's where we pick it up right now. We return to Isaiah's present time, and Isaiah again begins to deal with Israel's pathetic present condition, and then talks about how God will deal with the nation. Now, he talks about Israel here as the vineyard of the Lord. The vineyard of the Lord. The vineyard, so it's a parable of the vineyard in verses 1 through 7. And the parable of the vineyard begins with a song in chapter 5, verse 1. Let me sing now for my well-beloved a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. So the me there is Isaiah, and my beloved is God. So Isaiah calls God his beloved. It's a yadid, a very intimate term that means one greatly loved. God was Isaiah's personal friend. And Isaiah had an intimate acquaintance with God and saw things that few people were privileged to see. He understood the triunity, the triune nature of God, and speaks of it on numerous occasions. He was given the revelation of the virgin birth in Isaiah 7. We'll see that in just a short time when we get to chapter 7. He spoke of the death of the Messiah in Isaiah 53, and he spoke of the Messianic age numerous times throughout the book of Isaiah. So the object of the vineyard theme, the object of the song, is the vineyard of the Lord, and God's vineyard, we'll soon see, is Israel. Now he says, my beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. This means that the vineyard was on a horn. It was on a prominent mountain peak, projecting like a horn, and thus open to the sun on all sides. And the hill is called a son of fatness, literally in the Hebrew, a son of fatness. It's rendered fertile hill in the NASB, which is a great rendering of that term, because that term denotes fertility of the soil. So the first point here is the vineyard of the Lord has an ideal location. He's provided an ideal location for his vineyard. And then he provides ideal care for the vineyard in verse 2. He dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it. And he also hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. So he gave special care to his vineyard. He turned the soil. He gathered out the stones. And that is a particular Israeli problem because there's so many stones in the Israeli soil. In fact, the rabbis have a little story. They say that when God was creating the world, he sent an angel out with 10 bags of stones to scatter those stones all over the world. And what happened? The angel goofed and he dropped 9 of those stones on Israel. And, you know, you go to Israel and you see the soil and it's easy to believe that little story. Okay, so we have here now ideal location and ideal care, and then there's an ideal plant placed in the soil. So he planted the choicest vine, and then he built a tower. This tower was for protection against thieves when the grapes ripen. So now we have ideal protection for the vineyard. And here's a picture I took at Na'ot Kedomin, ancient gardens, a number of years ago. And this is their vineyard area, and you can see the tower they built to show us the kind of protective tower that would have been built in ancient days to protect the vineyard. So there's that tower in a vineyard right there. And then the owner of the vineyard hewed out a wine press in anticipation of the harvest because he had every right to expect good grapes. And I don't know how familiar you are with viticulture in ancient Israel, but we'll give you a quick tour of the process right now. In winemaking, grape growing, viticulture, First of all, the grapes are harvested, as this young lady is doing here in the picture. And then the grapes are taken over to the wine vat and dumped in the wine vat, where they are crushed by the workers. That frees the juice from the grapes, and the juice can flow out and be collected. And here is a picture of those beautiful grapes on the vine, picked from the vine, thrown into the wine vat, crushed by the workers, and the juice allowed to run free. That's the classic picture. And here is a drawing of a wine press in ancient Israel, again hewn out of the rock. Here we have the wine press where the workers crush the grapes, and then the juice flows down these channels into collecting vats where the juice is collected and to be processed into wine. Now here is a wine vat in the Nazareth village in Nazareth. And it's a good place to visit if you go to Israel, visit the Nazareth village. In the top of the picture here, we have the treading vat. This is where the workers would tread on the grapes and break the juice loose from the grapes. And down where my guide is standing is a storage vat where the juice would flow into the vat and be collected. And between them two is the channel allowing the juice to flow into the storage vat. So there's another wine press hewn out of the rock, just like the owner of the wine of the vineyard did in the book of Isaiah here. So he hoped for good grapes. Did he get good grapes? No, he reaped stinking grapes is the Hebrew there. Apparently these grapes were diseased and rotten. So the vineyard had an ideal location. It experienced ideal care. It was planted with an ideal vine. The vineyard received ideal protection, and there was ideal preparation for the harvest. And instead, the grapes were worthless. What's going to happen to the vineyard? Well, there'll be a judgment on the vineyard, of course. And so in verse 3, there's a call to Judah and Jerusalem to act as a judge. Isaiah 5:3. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. So this is a very emphatic call. The inference is, and now you pass judgment. Now the conclusion should be so obvious that they should have no problem with this call. They should have no problem figuring out what's going on. And the case is then God then puts forth his case in verse 4. What more is there to do for my vineyard than I have not done in it? Why then, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So the question, God's question, could he have done more? Could anyone have ever done more than was described for this vineyard? Apparently there's no answer given by those who were to act as judges. And since there's no answer, God himself will speak and say what he's going to do. Verse 5. So let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. So God is going to take away the hedge. This is the thorny hedge on top of a protective wall. This thorny hedge acted like ancient barbed wire, kept the animals out, and this hedge will be taken off the wall. In fact, the wall will be broken down. This would be a low stone wall that would protect the vineyard. Now here's another picture from Ne'ot Kedumim of their vineyard area, and here you see they've built a low stone wall and they've placed thorn bushes on top of the wall, the ancient barbed wire. And believe me, those thorns are sharp. They'll deter you from getting over that wall. But those thorn bushes will be taken off, the wall will be broken down, and the vineyard will be trodden down by animals and man and devoured and destroyed. So the result, the vineyard will become a wilderness in verse 6. I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain upon it. So God is going to neglect the vineyard. It'll be neglected and untended. It'll be overgrown with briars and thorns, and it will become a wilderness. No rain will fall on it. It'll suffer drought and dry up and become a wilderness. So now the practical application comes in verse 7. God does a drash here. He does a practical application. verse 7. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel and the men of Judah, his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. So now we see very clearly that the vineyard is Israel. The vineyard is very clearly identified as Israel and Judah, the whole nation, not the northern kingdom only, not the southern kingdom only. So Israel, the vineyard of the Lord, contrary to all expectation, produced bad fruit and will be given up to devastation. The northern kingdom will be given up to Assyria in 722, the southern kingdom being given up to Babylon in 586. Now, Isaiah describes the wild grapes, the rotten grapes, through a play on words. Isaiah is a master of the Hebrew, and he does a nice little play on words here. He says in Isaiah chapter 5, verse 7, he looked for justice. The word is mishpat. But behold, bloodshed. The word is mishpach. So he looked for mishpat, and behold, mishpach. You see the play on words there? And then he looked for righteousness, the word is tzedakah, but behold a cry of distress, tza'aka. He looked for tzedakah, but behold tza'aka. Again, a nice little word play that Isaiah does. Again, Isaiah is a master of the Hebrew. He loves to do those kinds of things. Now, this is an example of the parabolic technique. Many times the prophets prepare the listeners for the announcement of judgment to come. They do it through a listener and the listener comes to the correct conclusion. They conclude that judgment must inevitably follow. Then the prophet says, you're very correct. The story's about you, and you have correctly judged the situation and yourself. Therefore, listen to the judgment God will bring against you. This is what's happened here. There's other examples of the parabolic technique. You know, 2 Samuel 12, 1 through 7. 2 Samuel 12, 1 through 7. Another example is 1 Kings 20, 37 to 43. 1 Kings 20, 37 to 43. All right, God has just done a drash in verse 7, so let's do a little drash for ourselves as well. Let's think about some thoughts of application from Isaiah 2:22 through 5:7. So the theme I chose from this section of Scripture is, you shall know them by their fruit. And where did I get that theme? Well, I got it from the biblical data, the biblical application. In the Bible, we looked at the fruit of leadership. It wasn't justice and righteousness, but it was bloodshed and a cry. Previously, we looked at the fruit of the women, haughtiness and materialism. Again, bad grapes, stinking grapes. So let's make a personal application out of this. Instead of criticizing Israel, let's take a look at ourselves and ask the important question, what kind of fruit are we producing? What kind of fruit are we producing? Good fruit or bad fruit? You know, the fruit God wants from us is found in Galatians 5, 22 and 23. This is what God wants to come out of our lives. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. That's what he wants out of our life. Well, that's a big order. So why don't you just write down one type of fruit you would like to produce? Don't write them all down, because you'll be overwhelmed trying to handle all those character qualities. Just write down one, like patience. You know, I need more patience. God is working on me to make me more patient. So I'd like to see that fruit more evident in my life. So just write down one. Just write down one. One fruit that you would like to produce. And then let's move on from the head knowledge and intellectual knowledge to practical action, a plan of action. Write down something practical you could do to cooperate with God and produce that fruit. Produce the fruit of the Spirit that He wants in your life. All right, just some thoughts of application from Isaiah. And I hope those thoughts challenge you. They always challenge me. All right, let's move on to my next section here. All right. Now, in context, Isaiah is discussing the entire nation. He's discussing the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And at this point, we're in the prophet's present time in verses 1 through 7. Now, he moves to the near future in verses 8 through 30. He predicts the results of Israel's sin that occurred during his present time. What's going to happen in the near future to Israel because of this? And so we're going to deal with a section dealing with woes and judgments in verses 8 through 25. Now there's going to be six woes here. Remember, he expected Israel and Judah, his vineyard, to produce good grapes. But what did the vineyard produce? But instead, the vineyard produced the grapes of greed in verse 8, drunkenness in verse 11, disobedience in verse 18, perverting the truth in verse 20, false wisdom in verse 21, and injustice in verse 22. Those were the grapes and that are going to be discussed as we go through this section. And they'll be interspersed with four therefores, four results of the sin in the results of those bad grapes we just looked at. Now the woes are not so much against the thing itself, but against its extreme and its abuse. That's basically the idea here. The extreme and the abuse of something that's quite good. So the first woe is against greedy landowners in verse 8. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there's no more room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. So the first woe is against these greedy landowners appropriating the land. They're adding house to house in the city and field to field in the country, and there's no room for others. They're dominating the area, and they're dwelling alone. In other words, they're crowding people out. Now, this is contrary to the law of Moses. The law allowed for the appropriation of land, for example, in payment of a debt, but it had to be returned during the year of Jubilee. So the law assured possession of land. There's nothing wrong with having your plot of land. In fact, from the law's point of view, as many people as possible should have their own holdings of land and houses. You know, there should have been small property owners, lots of small property owners. But here, the small property owner was being driven out. And the greedy landowner didn't need the land, and he didn't necessarily use it. He just gloried in the mere possession of it. So this is the abuse of land ownership. Ownership of real estate. So the punishment of the first woe is in verse 9. In my ears, the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones, without occupants. Wow, in my ears, Isaiah says. This is a special revelation given to the prophet, and it shows the intimacy of his relationship with God. God whispers in his ear. What does he whisper about? He whispers about the judgment on the houses. They will be desolate to the extent of being totally unoccupied. And then he tells them about the judgment on the land in verse 10. For 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. And so famine will follow the depopulation. 10 acres of land will produce one bath. A homer will produce only an ephah. An ephah is 1/10 of a homer. See, the bath was liquid measure. The homer was dry measure. And what's the point here? The point here is instead of the land producing a tenfold increase, there will be a decrease of 9/10, a 90% decrease in the output of the land. Instead of plus 10%, it's going to be minus 90%. So the cruel and oppressive foreclosure of property will not lead to a successful financial life for this greedy landowner. Now we come to verse 11 and the second woe. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them. Now the Bible nowhere condemns drinking alcohol. The Bible nowhere condemns drinking alcohol, and in some places it even encourages drinking wine. For example, 1 Timothy 5:23, take a little wine for your stomach. But the Bible is consistently against drunkenness. God calls drunkenness a sin consistently throughout the Bible. Okay? Alcohol in moderation is okay. But if you're getting drunk, you've just moved into the area of sin. So this second woe is against those who rise early. They rise early for two purposes. So they may follow after strong drink. And they stay up late with wine inflaming them. Now the strong drink would be non-grape wines and beer. So they start drinking early in the day and they finish up late. And they close the day with a party in verse 12. Their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. So their drunkenness is compounded with music for the occasion. These guys are party animals. Let's party at the slightest excuse. And these parties are similar to the religious heathen practices, feasts composed with exciting music and wine. An example of this is Amos 6, 5 and 6, a heathen religious feast that's just like this. Now, the reason why wine and song are condemned in this case, see, nothing wrong with wine as such and nothing wrong with song as such. But in this case, they are condemned, not because wine and song are intrinsically wrong, but because they did not regard the work of the Lord and the operation of his hands. They had a lot of regard for alcohol and music, but none for God. And they used the alcohol and music and the parties to escape and avoid thinking about God's demands and his presence in their world. So the result is that they failed to see that troubles, the discipline God brought upon them, was designed to bring them back to the Lord. All right, now we come to verse 13 and the first therefore. As a result of all this, therefore, my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude is parched with thirst. So this is a reference to the captivity, the Babylonian captivity, that will be fulfilled 100 years or so later. And the cause? Lack of knowledge. They refused to learn God's judgments. They sought other escapes. They were interested in other things. They had plenty of opportunity to learn from the prophets and to learn from the Bible. They chose not to learn. And that parallels a lot of people all over the world today. There's plenty of opportunities in many places to learn about God and learn from his word, and people choose not to do so. They'd rather have wine and music and parties. So the end result, though, will be hunger and thirst. Now we come to a second therefore in verses 14 through 17. Four results will be brought out here. Verse 14, therefore, Sheol has enlarged its throat and opens its mouth without measure, and Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her din of revelry, and the jubilant within her descend into it. So the first result is physical death. Now Sheol is the place of the dead. Here it's pictured as a fierce, ravenous, insatiable beast. So that's the first result, physical death. Then comes the humbling of men in verse 15. And so the common man will be humbled and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud also will be abased. So he repeats the fact that the common man is bowed down. He uses the word Adam there, a generic word for mankind. And the great man is humbled. He uses the Hebrew word Ish there to focus on individuals. And the proud man is humbled. So the common man, the great man, and the proud man, all will be humbled. And the next result is the exaltation of the Lord in verse 16. But the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. So God is exalted when justice is exalted. He's a holy God, and he proves himself to be holy when he judges sin. The fourth result, verse 17, will be devastation on the land. Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture, and strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. So the whole land will only be good for grazing, no longer for crops, and it'll be occupied by foreigners, by strangers. In verse 18, then, we come to the third woe. Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as if with cart ropes. Now, this is concerned with those who willfully disobey and mock God, who deliberately mock God. The picture God uses here is of a man dragging a heavy cart. Iniquity is the burden in the cart, which they drew after them with cords of lying. The ropes that tied them to the cart are cords of lying. So sin was in the wagon, to which they were harnessed to with ropes. So they're proud of their unbelief, but this unbelief is like a yoke by which they were harnessed to sin. And when God punishes sin, they will be punished also, since they are harnessed to sin. They're connected with sin. Now, with apologies to Reb Tevye, here's a picture of Reb Tevye leaving on a Tevka with his cart. And notice he has roped himself to his cart in order to help him pull it. It's roped around his shoulder. But using the illustration in Isaiah here, what is in the cart? The burden in the cart is sin. The burden in the cart is sin. Now, the rabbis also understand this principle that sin can trap you. In Sukkah 52a, they have a very nice little statement here. Rav Asi said, "In the beginning, the evil angel appears as insignificant and thin as a cobweb. And finally, he becomes thick as a wagon rope. As it is written," and here's our verse, Isaiah 5:18, "as it is written, woe to those who draw iniquity with the cords of falsehood, and as with a wagon rope, sinfulness." And there's the picture there. Again, apologies, Reb Tevye, but your picture is an ideal illustration. Roped to sin, connected with sin. So when sin is judged, the man is judged. Okay, verse 19. There's talking about men who say, "Let him speed, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it. Let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it." In other words, I don't believe it until I see it, and I've never seen it yet. That's the idea in verse 19. I'll believe it when I see it, but I ain't never seen it yet. So they're challenging God to fulfill his promise of judgment. They went against the prophets. They challenged the prophets as well. And the same thing is happening even today. Peter tells us about that in 2 Peter 3, verses 3 and 4. Same principles happening today. "Know this first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts and saying, 'Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation.'" So they mock the promise of judgment. "Oh yeah, I ain't seen nothing, and I only believe it when I see it. It's never happened yet." This is what the atheist says. So things haven't changed, have they? Things have not changed from Isaiah's day down to our day, and they won't change in the future. In fact, they'll just get worse as we get into the tribulation period. The fourth woe is in verse 20. "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." So this woe is against those who pervert the truth, who twist the truth. There's no discernment of right and wrong. They have a false code of morals and ethics. They call good evil, and evil is called good. So the morals are upside down. The fifth woe, verse 21. "Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight." So this woe is against those who pride themselves in false wisdom. Now, the fear of the Lord is the foundation of true wisdom. The foundation of true wisdom, Proverbs 1:7. "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction." So these people in Isaiah's day were fools. So that's the foundation of wisdom. But the fundamental rule of wisdom is in Proverbs 3:7. The fundamental rule of wisdom: do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord. Turn away from evil. But these people are doing exactly the opposite of what the Proverbs tell us to do. They're violating the foundation and fundamental principle of wisdom. The sixth woe then is in verses 22 and 23. "Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right." So this judgment is against drunken judgments in courts of law. This is irony and mockery being expressed here. These men are heroes, but not in avenging wrong, but in drinking wine. They're heroes in drinking wine. And they're men of renown, not in deciding between guilt and innocence, but in how to mix a strong drink. This is an example of what's happening in verse 20. So they justify the wicked and declare the righteous to be not guilty. These are the drunken judges. The third, therefore, comes in verse 24. Therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass, let me start from the beginning there. Therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust, for they have rejected the law of the Lord, the law of the Lord of hosts, and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. So this is a picture of total destruction. The sour grapes are ripe only for burning. And so in the verse there, it talks about root and blossom. Root and blossom. That's a picture of totality. The whole thing is going to be burned up, from the root, which is in the ground, to the blossom, which is high up on the vine. Everything in between, totality, will be destroyed. And the reason is the rejection of Revelation. They rejected the law of the Lord, the Mosaic law. They rejected the word of the Lord, the prophet's message. And so then in verse 25, the fourth therefore comes. On this account, translated in this particular version, on this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people, and he has stretched out his hand against them and struck them down. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses lay like refuge in the middle of the streets. For in all this, his anger is not spent, and his hand is stretched out still. So the slaughter here is the slaughter of battle. And in all this, God's wrath will not turn away. His hand is stretched out, ready to strike again. In other words, there will be no relief from this judgment. And this is a very common phrase in Isaiah, that his hand is stretched out. We'll see it over and over and over again. So the closing, we'll close this section. The closing remarks of this section are in verses 26 through 30 with an explanation of the judgment on the nation. In verse 26, the invading army is called. It will also lift up a standard to the distant nation and will whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. So this is the means by which verse 25 will be fulfilled. The call, the whistle, is to the nation of Babylon, like a whistling for your dog. And he comes. He hears the signal and he comes. But this is a call to the nation of Babylon. And Babylon will obey swiftly. That's in contrast to Judah, who doesn't obey at all. So the approach of the nation is in verse 27. No one in it is weary or stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps. Nor is the belt of its waist undone, nor is its sandal strap broken. So this approach is relentless and unstoppable. Then in verse 28, their weapons are described. Its arrows are sharp, and all its bows are bent. The hooves of its horses seem like flint, and its chariot wheels like a whirlwind. So they're prepared. They're prepared and they're well equipped. It's a prepared and well equipped army. Their attack in verses 29 and 30. Its roaring is like a lioness, and it roars like young lions, and growls as it seizes the prey and carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it will growl over it in the day like the roaring of the sea. So their attack is like a fierce lioness. There's the prey. That lioness is taking that prey down. And that's what will happen. Babylon will take Judah down like a fierce lion. And the results then are in verse 30. If one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress. Even the light is darkened by its clouds. So defeat and disaster is the view that you see as the landscape that lies before you. No matter where they look, all is clouded, dark, and black. So the devastation is complete. Now this judgment will be fulfilled in the Babylonian conquest and captivity, approximately 100 years after Isaiah spoke. Now this ends the Song of the Vineyard, the parable, the picture that Isaiah drew at the beginning, and then applied to the nation throughout chapter 5, applied it to the nation during his present time. So he drew this picture in chapter 5 and applied it to the nation. So here's a quick summary of the vineyard motif that the chapter began with. We'll look at the stage, a scripture, and a comment. The first stage of the vineyard motif is the exodus of the nation in Psalm 80, verses 8 through 11. The vine, God's vine, is transplanted from Egypt to Israel. Psalm 80, verses 8 through 11. Then the second stage is in the land, Isaiah 5, verses 1 through 7. Also, let's look at Jeremiah 2, 21, and 12, 10, and 11, and Hosea 10, 1 through 3. So the next stage is in the land. The vineyard bears sour grapes, bad grapes, and becomes desolate. That's what we just read about. The next stage is during the first century in the land, Matthew 21, 33 through 46. The vine is controlled by wicked vine dressers, and that's the conflict that Yeshua had with the those who were ruling Israel in his days. This is why the vine produced bad grapes and had to be judged. The next stage is the tribulation period in Psalm 80, verses 12 through 19. The vine will seek the help of the Lord. And finally, we come to the Messianic kingdom in Isaiah 27. We'll get to that eventually, of course. And now, the vine fills the world with fruit. It fills the world with the fruit that God wants. They show the good grapes. Finally produces good grapes. Now notice that when the vineyard motif repeats the pattern, we've already seen in the book of Isaiah. God cares for and nurtures Israel. Israel rebels and produces sin and evil. The responsibility for this rebellion is laid on the shoulders of Israel's leadership. Therefore, God judges his vineyard. But eventually, that's not the end of the story, eventually, the vine will seek God and will produce the good grapes that God desires during the millennial kingdom. So this is only one of several motifs God uses to describe his relationship with his people and the pattern that that relationship will follow. All right, Isaiah has introduced a number of themes so far in the book. Let's take a quick review of what these themes are. The first theme is the Messianic kingdom. We've got a few glances at the Messianic kingdom. We've taken a look at the Messianic person. He's introduced us to the Messianic people. All the Jewish people will be saved and will be holy. But currently, the nation's present condition is very pathetic. It consists of outward prosperity and inward apostasy. And that description is something you should remember as well. Outward prosperity, inward apostasy. Keep that in mind. We've looked at the tribulation period. We've had another look at the Millennial Mountain. We've been introduced to the Millennial Mountain of the Lord. We've seen a number of manifestations of the Shekinah glory in the kingdom. We've run into this theme that we're going to see over and over again. His hand is stretched out still. We've just finished up looking at the vineyard of the Lord and the responsibility of Israel's leadership. All right, so remember now, this is a three-step book. In the first five chapters, Isaiah said, this is what I'll be talking about. Chapters 1 through 5. Then in chapter 6, he deals with his call to prophetic office. Here's my authority to talk about these subjects. That's the upcoming chapter. And then there's an explanation of these themes, these subjects. Here are the details regarding the subjects I'll be talking about, chapter 7 through 66. So here's where we are right now. We're just getting ready to enter into chapter 6. Here is my authority to talk about all these themes, to talk about all these subjects. So he's in the near future talking about the Babylonian invasion upon Judah. And now he jumps back to his own present time in chapter 6, verses 1 through 10, and we deal with the call of Isaiah in verses 1 through 13. So we begin with his vision of the throne of God in verses 1 through 4. We see he begins in the heavenly temple, the temple of God, in verse 1. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, and the train of his robe filling the temple. Now this would be the heavenly temple. Isaiah would not be allowed into the earthly temple. Only priests from the Levitical line were allowed in there, and there's no indication that he's a priest or a Levite. So he would not be allowed in the earthly temple. Now he states, in the year King Uzziah died, that would be 759 BC, he mentions this specific date, the year that the king died. We will suggest a reason for that later on. And he said that he saw the Lord sitting upon a throne. And here's a great contrast. Judah's king may die, Uzziah might die, but this eternal king will never die. So God is forever on his throne, watching over the destiny of his people. What's the significance of the throne? The throne shows that the king is ready to practice his kingly prerogatives to judge and pronounce judgment. So he's ready to rule. That's the idea. Now, Isaiah saw the Lord, he says. Now, let's talk about this issue of seeing God. Can man see God? Well, we've learned in the Torah that no man can see the essence of God and live. Exodus 19:21. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, go down, warn the people that they do not break through to the Lord and gaze, look upon him, and many of them perish. Can man see God? No. And then in Exodus 33:20, Moses says, show me your glory. And he said to him, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. So he puts Moses in a rock and lets him see his back. Okay. So we cannot see the unvarnished essence of God and live. In fact, that's repeated in the Brit HaDeshah. Can man see God? John 1:18. No one has seen God at any time. Okay. And that's followed up by Rabbi Shaul in 1 Timothy 6:15 and 16. He was blessed, he who is the blessed and only sovereign, the King of kings and Lord of lords, who alone possesses immortality and dwells in unapproachable light, to whom no man has seen or can see. To him be honor and eternal dominion. Amen. All right, so man cannot see the essence of God and live, and man has not seen God at any time. Now, in light of the verses in Exodus, the Gospel of John, and 1 Timothy, who did Isaiah see? What did Isaiah see? Well, actually, Isaiah saw the pre-incarnate Messiah, a pre-incarnate appearance of God. And John 12:36 through 41 indicates this for us. In John 12, we read, Yeshua is speaking now, while you have the light, believe in the light, so that you may become sons of light. These things Yeshua spoke, and he went away and hid himself from them. But though he had performed so many signs before them, yet they were not believing in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For this reason they could not believe. For Isaiah said again, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart so that they would not see with their eyes and perceive with their heart and be converted, and I heal them. These things Isaiah said, why? Because he saw his glory and he spoke to him. So John is quoting Isaiah chapter 6 here, proving that Isaiah saw a pre-incarnate form of God, the pre-incarnate Messiah. Now, let's summarize all this up in a chart. Can man see God? We'll look at the form of God, whether it's visible, the scripture. Excuse me. And an example. The first form we'll talk about is the pure essence of God, the unvarnished pure essence of God. Can man see that? No. That's what we're talking about in Exodus 19, Exodus 33, John 1, and 1 Timothy 6. And when Moses wanted to see the pure essence of God, God refused Moses. That's in Exodus 33:23. No. You do that and you'll be vaporized, Moses. All right, so we cannot see the pure essence of God. Can we see a pre-incarnate appearance of God? A pre-incarnate appearance of the Shekinah? Yes, we can. We can see a pre-incarnate appearance of God in the form of the angel of the Lord. Genesis 32:30, Jacob wrestled with a man. That man was the angel of the Lord. And Judges 13:22, Manoah saw the angel of the Lord. So yes, we can see a pre-incarnate appearance of the Shekinah glory in the form of an angel. What about an incarnate appearance? Incarnation means God putting on a body, appearing in a body. This is what the Brit Chadashah, the New Covenant, is all about. Yes, there are two forms of the glory of God we can see when God was incarnate in the body of Yeshua. First of all, there was a veiled form where his body hid the light of his glory. That's in John 10:33, for example, one of a number of places. You being a man, make yourself out to be God. See, his opponents are talking to him, and they very clearly understood that Jesus said, I am the God-man. So they were seeing an incarnate, a veiled form of God himself. But there's also an unveiled incarnate form that we see in the Brit Chadashah, and we can see that as well. And that's seen in Matthew 17 and Matthew Mark in the Transfiguration. Here, Yeshua allowed his glory to penetrate through the body. They took the veil that was his body away. And the disciples could see that in his glory, the light of his glory in the Transfiguration. And then in Revelation 1, 12 and 18, there'll be no veiling of his glory there, and John sees the glorified Jesus as well. So we cannot see the unveiled essence of God, but when he clothes himself in a form that allows us to see him, first as the angel of the Lord and now as Yeshua, then we can see God. So Isaiah saw one of these pre-incarnate manifestations of Yeshua, one of these pre-incarnate manifestations of God. So the king that he saw was high and lifted up. And this is a good contrast between Judah's king and the Messianic king. Judah's king may sin, but this king will not sin. And then his train filled the temple. So magnificent is the appearance of God that his robe alone fills the temple in heaven. So this is the heavenly temple. And there's a number of verses referring to the heavenly temple in Scripture. 1 Kings 22:19, Psalm 11:4, Psalm 18:6, Psalm 29:9, Jonah 2:7, Habakkuk 2:20, Micah 1:2. So we know there is a heavenly temple. So we've been introduced to the earthly temple and the heavenly temple here. And I would like to make a little side trip now just to make sure you're a little bit more acquainted with these biblical teachings than most people. A lot of people are not familiar at all with the temples and the tabernacle. So let me make a fairly detailed side trip here. I don't think we'll be able to get all the way through it in this session. We'll pick it up next session and finish up. But let's take a look at the temple. Now we know there is a heavenly temple, first of all, from Exodus 25:8 and 9. Let them construct a sanctuary for me, that I may dwell among them, according to all that I'm going to show you as the pattern, and the word there basically means a blueprint, as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furniture. Just so you shall construct it. And then in verse 40, the admonition, see that you make them after the pattern for them, which was shown you on the mountain. So Moses, make sure you follow my plan. Then the book of Hebrews picks up this idea for us and expands it a little bit more. Now, the main point in what has been said is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister in the sanctuary and the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched, not man. So in heaven, the real thing is in existence. What we have on earth is not the real thing. And the writer of Hebrews goes on to explain it. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. So it is necessary that this high priest, speaking of Yeshua, also have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, if Yeshua were an earthly priest, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer gifts according to the law. He would have to be from the Levitical order. Since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly thing. See, that's what the earthly tabernacle is. That's what the earthly temples are. They are a copy and a shadow of the real thing in the heavenly dimension, in the heavenly area, in the heavenly realm. I don't care what you call it. In the heavenly dimension. Okay, so we're dealing with a copy and a shadow. And the writer of Hebrews makes it very clear as he finishes up, just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle, for see, he says, that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain. Moses, make sure you build this tabernacle accurately because it's representing the real thing in the heavenly realm. So here's some drawings of the tabernacle by various artists. Of course, we didn't have any photographic material there to take an actual picture of the tabernacle, so we can only estimate what it looked like through drawings. Well, here's a tabernacle and temple timeline that I've built going from left to right, and we're going to place our temples and tabernacle on this timeline. The tabernacle was first finished in 1446 B.C., and it lasted until 1960 B.C., 1446 to 1960. It was built in the wilderness, and here is an artist's rendition of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai, and there is the center of the camp with the tabernacle, dead center in the camp. Here's a close-up. We see the tabernacle surrounded by the tents of Levi. The tents on the outside would be the tents of the tribes of Israel. Now, this is a model of the tabernacle in Timnah Park in Israel that tourists can go view and take a look at. Now, the tabernacle in the center of Israel was surrounded by in a very specific order. Here's the tabernacle in the center of the Lord, in the center of the host's vineyard. And to the east, Moses, Aaron, and the priests had their tents. Then to the south, Kohath, to the west, Gershom, and to the north, Merari, the three Levitical tribes, the Levites. Then, surrounding the camp of the Levites, to the east, the tribe of Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, to the south, Reuben, Simeon, and Gad, to the west, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, and to the north, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. So that's how the camp of Israel was set up for the march from Egypt to the Promised Land. Now, the tabernacle was a portable worship area, a worship compound, 150 feet long, 75 feet wide, set off by these fences. It was set up in an east and west direction. And you entered the tabernacle from the entrance on the east side. As you came into the tabernacle, the first item you would run into would be the altar of burnt offering, the altar of sacrifice. Now here is the Timnah Park tabernacle model. Here is their altar. We'll have another photo of it. Here is the altar that has been created in Timnah Park. So you can visit that if that is still in operation in Israel. There's another artist's rendering of the altar. We don't know exactly what it looked like, so we have to go from a description from the Bible, and of course artists view that differently. Now this is a stone altar at Beersheba, and the reason I put this stone altar in here is because the horns on the altar are so prominent. That's a very typical design feature of altars. Horns were the symbol of an animal's strength. So here we have a symbol of strength on the altars. So you'll see horns on all the altars. All right, after counting the altar, you would then move to the west to the laver and encounter the laver. The laver was where the priests would wash themselves after offering the sacrifices. And here's the Timnah Park laver in that location. And here's a close-up of their representation of the laver, just a water bowl in which the priests could wash themselves. Now, this is the laver according to the Temple Institute. This is the way they feel it looked, at least in Herod's temple. And so they've constructed a laver for the third temple when it's built. It's in their building today, a Temple Institute building. So we pass the altar, we pass the laver, then we come to the tabernacle itself. Now here is the tabernacle. It is a tent, a portable worship area. It was approximately 45 feet long, 15 feet wide, and 15 feet high. Now as you entered the tabernacle proper, you would enter a building of two rooms. The front room was the larger room, and it was called the holy place, and it contained three articles of furniture. First of all, a table of showbread. Here, unleavened bread was kept before the Lord. Here's an artist's rendering of the table of showbread. It might have looked like that. This is probably a pretty good rendering of it as well. And this is the table of showbread according to the Temple Institute. This is the way the rabbis think it looks. So they have built, of course, a table of showbread according to their convictions there. So here's some few pictures of the table of showbread according to the Temple Institute. After the table of showbread, there's an altar of incense in the western end of the room in front of the screen. Here's a possible rendition of the altar of incense. You can see the horns on the altar there. And here is a rendition of it standing before the screen in the west end of the holy place. This is the incense altar according to the Temple Institute. A little different design, but this is what the rabbis feel should be in the third temple. This is an illustration of the daily incense offering. The priest on the left has placed coals on the altar. The priests on the right are preparing the dry, powdered incense. And here a priest, it can be the high priest or a Levitical priest, either one, pours the powdered incense on the coals, and the fragrant smoke rises up and fills the holy place, penetrates beyond the veil into the Holy of Holies, the other room. It's a picture of prayer. And then finally, to the south, there's the menorah or the lampstand, providing light for the holy place. This is a picture of the lampstand created by the Romans when they destroyed the temple in 70 AD. This is a relief on the Arch of Titus, and you can see the lampstand right there. Now, scientists have taken flecks of paint off the Arch of Titus, analyzed them, and come up with the colors that the relief was painted when it was brand new, just finished. And so this is the way they think the Arch of Titus looked when it was brand new. Very colorful. And there, of course, is the golden menorah. And so this design is about the only design we have of the menorah. We don't really know what it looked like other than the Arch of Titus. It appears on Israel's coat of arms. Here's another rendition of the Israeli coat of arms. And this is the menorah according to the Temple Institute. A little different, but similar to what the Romans drew there on their relief. This is when it was located in the Cardo. It has been moved since. It's not in the Cardo presently. So here's some pictures I took a number of years ago before it was moved. And then here's a Levite attending the lamps, keeping them in good shape because they were to be burning constantly. And this is an alternate view of the menorah, according to the Temple Institute, by different rabbis. So they have chosen the curved branch version rather than the straight branch version. So that is the holy place. Then a veil separated the front room from the rear room. And as you moved through the veil, you would come into the Holy of Holies, the most sacred area of the tabernacle. In the Holy of Holies, one piece of furniture resided, the Ark of the Covenant. And this is the Ark of the Covenant according to the Temple Institute. They feel that this is what it should look like. And the importance of the Ark of the Covenant is that the Shekinah glory of God would appear over the cherubim and over the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. And this is why only the high priest could enter on one day of year on Yom Kippur to atone for the people's sin, because God himself, in the form of his Shekinah glory, would locally manifest himself over the Ark of the Covenant. Here's another picture conveying that same idea. Another artist rendition of the Ark of the Covenant. Perhaps it looked like this, we really don't know. And so that is the tabernacle. This is another drawing of the tabernacle showing another possible way that it was constructed. Instead of being boards, here it's being constructed of framework surrounding it. Well, that's another rendition. Now, what is the meaning of the tabernacle? Well, Hertz Pentateuch on this subject, the rabbi has some interesting comments to say. He says, practically all commentators are agreed that the sanctuary is a symbol and its purpose to impress the children of men with spiritual teachings. We would agree with him there. What, however, were the spiritual teachings which the tabernacle symbolized? This question offered full scope to the ingenuity of mystic interpreters, ancient and modern, Jewish and non-Jewish. Ingenuity. Is that how we're supposed to determine the meaning of a symbol? Think about it. These men who used their ingenuity and who declared the sanctuary to be an epitome of that which is presented on a larger scale in the universe as a whole, and an emblem of religion's profoundest teachings on life and eternity. So we would agree, it's a symbol of profound teachings from the Lord. Then the Jewish Encyclopedia, on the article on tabernacle, says this: it's probable that the characteristic features of the place of worship in the Old Testament bore, in addition to their outward purpose, an inner relationship to religious ideas. We would agree with that as well. But what are the ideas? Pinchas Giller in the Jerusalem Post in 1997 made this interesting comment. He said, the dimensions, decorations, and rituals of the tabernacle take up better part of the books of Leviticus and Exodus and Leviticus and make up a large part of the content of the Torah. Comprising such a large part of the law's content, these texts demand serious theological interpretation and application. In figurative terms, they cry out, Darshani, explain me, explain me. Well, how are we going to explain the tabernacle? Using man's ingenuity? Well, I'm going to offer you a different way. I'm going to ask you to use the golden rule of interpretation. When the plain sense of Scripture makes common sense, seek no other sense. Therefore, take every word at its primary, ordinary, usual, literal meaning, unless the facts of the immediate context, studied in light of related passages and axiomatic and fundamental truths, indicates other words. So we're not going to use ingenuity. We're going to use the golden rule of interpretation. All right, we've run out of time at this session. So next session, we'll continue through our side trip through the tabernacle, and we'll take a look at this idea of what does the tabernacle symbolize? What does it mean? What is its reason for existence? It cries out, Darshani, explain me. And we'll do that next session. Thanks so much for being our students. We'll see you next session. Lahitra'ot. Lahitra'ot.